Hello and welcome to College Crosscast. I'm Ryan. I'm joined by both Safe and Jake. Getting into the 4th of July weekend this week, so we are now in the summer, and now we have a little bit more free time, and not like that much has been happening anyway. I think since our last episode, the only real development was that Jeff Teets confirmed to still be at Cornell, and that's really about it. So we opened up the Twitter lines for you to ask some questions, so that's what we'll do tonight. So first off, how's everybody doing?
Good, good. You know, obviously happy to hear you guys again. State's starting to open up a little bit, but they shut down the possibility of indoor dining today, which is a little bit of a bummer. I mean, not that much of a surprise given what stuff's going on, but it was kind of gave me a little feeling of, we might be going backwards a little bit, which was, kind of disheartening, given everything we've gone through for these last, 16 weeks or whatever. But at least we get to, talk a little lacrosse and stuff like that today.
So, as we said, not really much of anything going on in the lacrosse news. So,
Did we talk about T coming back to Cornell? I think that's, not to, it's big news for Cornell, obviously. No two ways about spinning that. But I mean, it's interesting. I don't think any of their other seniors are coming back. I know there was talk and rumors that they were anticipating, I think Chris reported that they were anticipating they were getting like five seniors back. But I just don't. I mean, we haven't heard anything since Teets' announcement, and I just don't really see how that's feasible, considering all of the rest of them beside Teets graduated. And we know the Ivy League's stance on graduates. I guess you could say, well, we've already had Teet and TD come back, so there's ways around it. But to my knowledge, neither of those two technically graduated for whatever reason. And so, in essence, they were still eligible to play in the Ivy. So it looks like Teet's the only one that's coming back. And I mean, it's just an interesting decision. If a lot of them were coming back, I would understand. But him being the only one, I thought he would just go to the NLL and play pro. Basically, he'll be the number one pick, and he'll have a big following in that league, considering it's, mostly a Canadian-driven league, and he's probably the most famous Canadian lacrosse player out there right now. But I guess not, look, him coming back makes them a lot better than they would be without him, obviously. But I still think they lost too much to be in the mix with the top three or four teams that we've been mentioning, every time we kind of address the transfers. And so, I mean, obviously he probably feels different. He thinks they can still make, a run for a title, but it's, I think they're in the top 10, but I don't think they're in the top 5, and I think the top 5 is probably going to have a stranglehold on things next year, if there's next year. So it's just a bit interesting, kind of a bit surprising. And he already had taken a post-grad year after high school as well, so I didn't quite, see him wanting to come back for another year anyway. But he decided to, and he'll have another big year, obviously. And again, Cornell still has good player and good talent around him. And he gives them, a leg up over, say, Princeton, who wasn't able to really bring back anybody. And so they'll still be, Yale only brought back TD. So he gives them a leg up for sure in the Ivy with his return.
Yeah, definitely a personal blow to my brand, obviously. But I know for sure. I mean, we love Teet.
Loved him since he got there. Aside from Chris, who had his own little campaign for 1 year, we've definitely been Team Teat. Arguably, him and Pat Spencer, the free Pat Spencer campaign, really helped put us on the map. But the subsequent free Jeff Teat campaign the very next year really kind of helped us blow up. But no, obviously. So happy for him to come back just to see him play. He's just such a wonderful player. And, you know, it's really happy that he bounced back from, you know, while it was still a great season for almost 95% of the other players, as but his, you know, his 2019 year was definitely a bit of a drop back. Yeah, 2019 year was a bit of a drop back from, you know, what he was doing, his especially considering his sophomore year. But yeah, no, I hear what you're saying, Jake. Definitely Cornell lost a good amount. I think it's just like a bit of a, you know, war of attrition for all of those. Would consider Princeton loss, especially not of those three, they were the only one not able to in some way to bring back their biggest gun, which you know, definitely probably is driving a lot of Tigers fans crazy. Exactly. Like, oh, you know, you jump, we jump, you know, and then they looks like it kind of looks a little bit like Cornell and yells at psych when Princeton. Yeah.
We weren't totally, you know, like, you can get in the boat, but we'll, you know, we'll put one foot ashore.
Yeah, exactly. It really did remind me of the Titanic, you know, you jump, I jump, and they were like, well, on second thought, as Princeton right. leaps. But, no, for sure, it's, him coming back with Piatelli that probably gives them the most potent 1-2 punch in the Ivy. Even with all their losses, you know, Cornell did, you can always fall back on having those two really big guys coming back. But yeah, it's also, you know, just hard. Like, I think for the Ivy in general, they had what was shaping up to be an extremely, you know, albeit, you know, maybe not all of them are Final Four bound, but, like, you know, it was a wonderful, beautiful year for the Ivy last year. You had four teams in top 10 at one point, almost, I think, four in the top 8. One of the last final weeks before the season, you had Cornell, arguably the best team in the country after that thrilling Penn State game. You know, it was shaping up to just be like a, you know, almost Big Ten 2017 type of year for them. You know, obviously COVID had different plans, but, you know, I think they'll have definitely, if we get back to playing next year on time and a full schedule for everybody, you know, Cornell should have a lot to say in the early rounds. But yeah, you know, when you look at teams like Duke, who's, you know, going to be rocking with everybody back, you know, even Penn State too a little bit, even though they lost Grant, you know, you're going to have a couple other teams, UNC, you know, they'll be pretty potent again next year, just pretty much bringing everyone back. You know, obviously Chris Gray now is going to have another year as well.
But Connor Fletcher, you know, too.
Counterfight, yeah, absolutely. So they'll, you know, they'll be Cornell will be there, but I think just for the Ivy in general, it's just going to be hard to recapture that magic that they had going in 2020. It was, you know, it was a really impressive year by all of them. You know, but like, yeah, they've all lost a good amount, and Princeton not being able to keep Sowers, you know, it's going to be really difficult for them to run it back like they did in 2020. But you know, like I said, just as a general cross fan, not just specifically a Hopkins fan, I'm extremely happy for Jeff Teat. You know, he was one of our favorite players, and especially, you know, just speak for myself, just one of my favorite players in the game. So I'm just happy to he'll have an opportunity to have at least another crack at it in the college game in 2021.
I see you disrespecting the 2020 national champion Syracuse Orange by not mentioning them.
Well, I mean, I'm kidding. Look, it goes already shot 2020. Yeah. Can't be greedy.
Greatness. I mean, they really don't. They need to go without saying. They're just, it was what the and they're still in the running for Michael Sowers, according to
Yeah, exactly.
So. Apparently, I'm not believing
that. What is there more to say about a team whose three of their five wins were Colgate, Binghamton, and Johns Hopkins?
I got your subtweet too there. I like it. No, but all kidding aside, it's going to be awesome to have Teep back. I mean, I wouldn't blame him for going to the shores of the NLL, and, you know, it's extremely profitable, as we were saying, for Canadian players in the NLL. They could make a pretty penny with that, but Teep wants to go another go-around with Cornell, so it should be a good bounty for us college lacrosse fans.
And they do have some guys coming in with a lot of talent. I mean, I know there's a lot of questions up in the air about what contribution high school seniors can make next year, considering they didn't really have a season. And if there's no fall ball, a lot of those guys won't have played lacrosse in close to 18 months, in-game action. So there is that, question. But CJ Kirst was a top 10 recruit in the class at Attack. And Michael Long, came in immediately last year, again, much different circumstances, and contributed for Cornell, had 19 points in five games. And he really took the load off T in terms of ball handling and being able to run the offense, so that not so much attention was dedicated to T, as we saw in part, some of his, I don't want to say decline, but drop in, performance in 2019 was because, there was just, he was every, so much attention. Teams just focused on him to a singular degree that they just didn't focus on with anyone else. So he'll be back. Piatelli, as they've mentioned, is a great finisher. So then they're bringing another one. So they could have, potentially a really good, group again on the offensive side of the ball. That will allow them to, I don't know if they're going to, they scored 18 goals a game. They were averaging, they were just preposterous on the offensive side of the ball, and they have been. But new coaching, that's another thing we didn't even really mention. I know it's the same staff, essentially, but it's still a change. This is Busick's first year as a head coach, and he kind of just rose through Cornell, so it's not, he had experience maybe coaching, high school at, a lower kind of level, and there will be a lot to handle there. So that's, something in the mix that's going to make things difficult as well. I think defense is really where they kind of are going to be hurt. They were not great on defense as is, but they're losing Sam Duggan, who we had as an All-American in the shortened season, a short stick committee. He's a fantastic player. Brandon Salvatore is one of the best long poles in the country. They lost some solid guys there on the defense side of the ball, and then in the midfield as well, Telesco and Fletcher, who both gave them, a good bit. They might be a bit overloaded at attack with three guys I mentioned, and then Kyrus. Maybe they move one of them in midfield, so we'll see. So they're bringing in talent still. That's one thing. When we talked about the Ivies, people were, when I mentioned that I think the Ivies would be really bad. They were going to really kind of struggle to some degree, at least comparatively to the other top teams for a couple of years. People mentioning that, talent is continuing to come through, and it is. The Ivies recruit really well, but it's a bit different. You don't have kids locked in from, ninth grade anymore. A lot of guys are going into, your current freshmen or sophomores in college have not committed yet, unlike how it was a couple of years ago. And are guys going to want to commit, to a school if they know that they're only, with just how everything, is going on, the Ivies might not look at in as favorable a position. But on the other hand, perhaps potentially, they look at the schools like a Duke or a Maryland and say, holy crap, there's so many of these dudes, just sliding down the list. That's the stuff, that we'll have to see.
Mm-hmm. So definitely some interesting trends to be on the lookout for when it comes to the Ivies in the years ahead. So we opened up, we got a couple questions for today's episode. So But I think we all kind of want to address the big monkey in the room, which is, well, what the heck are we going to be doing next year? So this ties into a tweet we got from our good friend at D3 Football Huddle. So what do you guys think happens to fall ball / how does it change, especially now with leagues like the NESCAC, the New England D3 Conference, canceling fall sports? He also wants to mention that he played outside with his band for the first time in 4 months, and it was hot out. They were rusty, but it was still fun, so good to see that he's getting the band back together, so to speak. But this does kind of address the, well, what the heck's going on? So to reset what's going on right now with college sports is you have some of the D3 schools starting to cancel fall sports, and that's... We're going to see if that's a trend or not. At the moment, it looks like that FBS football is going to try and go full speed ahead, as much as it's not looking that great, because it seems like every team that's holding these workouts is having a spike in COVID cases everywhere, to the point where, like, Dabo Sweeney's totally doing a herd immunity practice at this rate at Clemson. So this kind of brings about something that Sports Illustrated, Chris sent our way, is that the Ivy League is considering two options. One would be to have the 2020 season start in September and just have an in-conference schedule, and then wrap it all up by Thanksgiving. And you see some rumors here and there of, you know, of conferences getting rid of non-con games and kind of keeping it compact regionally. The other option is that they would shut down football till next spring and have football be a spring sport. So, as we've been saying since the pandemic really began in March, is that a lot of this is going to revolve around what does college football do? Well, there's a whole lot of mixed messaging going on, but there's a lot of different possibilities on the table. So, let's just, for the sake of this exercise, expect fall ball to be completely pushed to the wayside. We're not going to have fall ball. So, with next year, we've kind of come to an agreement that schools need football one way or another. Would a move to the spring do anything to lacrosse, or is it just going to be, all right, we'll play the games when the football team's not on Saturdays, and just if they share a stadium, move it to the soccer field or whatever? So, I guess the question is, with the way the college sports landscape is looking, where the fall sports might be moved to the spring, as we know with the race for the vaccine, Dr. Fauci and the CDC still expecting it end of the year, beginning of next year, which would open things up for the spring for college sports. Can lacrosse coexist with football if need be, or are we looking at a situation where we might not even be talking about lacrosse until 2022?
Tough question.
Yeah. You want to tackle fall first and then the possibility of football in the spring second? I guess that'd be the...
Yeah, I guess so. We could explore both options.
Definitely. I mean, I'll go first, Jake, and then...
Go ahead, yeah, absolutely. I'm still thinking through.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to... just because it kind of tied into that article, and it has been something I've been thinking for a minute now. For a little while, it looked like, you know, when the numbers were going down, again, a caveat, full caveat, none of us are epidemiologists, and these are just, just banter here. It looked like... Yeah, there was a period where it definitely looked like a good amount of optimism, especially like in Jersey and New York, that the numbers were getting better and stuff like that. But now with these increase in cases around the country, there's definitely been a regression in positivity. And I think, give a silver lining that while the cases going up is disheartening, like that in and of themselves isn't the final arbiter, because if it's more younger people are the ones who are getting these, and they've started to find out that probably a lot more people have been exposed to it for a long time, as long as the hospitalizations aren't going up appreciably, and the death rate is going up. It's more that it's a somewhat of a good thing, because then it is helps us get to herd immunity. But as the numbers go up, people do get frightened, rightfully so, after what we just experienced these last 3 months. There's going to be a lot more hesitation to reopen things. Like I said, just at the beginning, Jersey essentially nixed the idea of indoor dining that was supposed to start in July 2nd. So I think there's so many things are in flux, and that it's hard to have, it's hard for these schools to, say, okay, here's our plan, because that could definitely just change, within the hour. Having said that, you also have the point of, if these schools, when they reopen, how they reopen could have a big part of it as well for the fall sports. If you have a situation like, what Notre Dame is trying to do, they're like, hey, we're opening, we're going back to business. And then you have other schools that say, hey, we're reopening, but it's going to be, Jake, you may even have more insight because you're the one in college right now. We're going to be I think Syracuse had a thing as well, Ryan, so maybe you have some thoughts. We're going to be part in class, part virtual, or schools like Hopkins where they said, yeah, we're going to be back, but it's not mandatory for kids to come back to campus. You can still stay home and do virtual learning if you want. So it depends on like those schools. So if you have like situations where you have these schools are doing everything possible to not have all the kids back all the time in class, it's hard for me to see them turning around and saying, yep, go ahead, coaches, do whatever you got to do, do what you want to do for the fall sports. I think the schools with the more conservative, part in class, part virtual learning in the fall are going to be the ones less likely to have all their sports in the fall, going full board. And then you have the schools who, like I said, if like a Notre Dame, forgive me if they've changed their mind and since their original plan goes, but you have these schools like Notre Dame, is that, yep, we're going back. Come on back to campus, boys and girls. Things, we're going to do everything that we can. Then, they're the ones who are more likely to have fall sports. But, those schools, even the ones who want to go full slate, everyone come back, we're going to have in-person classes and stuff like that. If all the other schools around them and in their conferences don't have the same mindset, who are those schools going to play? Who are they going to compete with? Brian, as you pointed out in that Sports Illustrated article for football, yeah, maybe the Ivy does have football, but they're like, we're just going to play with our little conference here, and we're not going to have any non-conference games. So if you're a school that has the Ivy, like the Patriot League, you have two or three Ivy League teams on your schedule, that kind of really limits your opponents that you're going to have for the fall. So I think a lot of these schools, at the end of the day, maybe I'm just a cynical lawyer friend on the pod, but at the end of the day, I think they're rightfully also, I'm not trying to say that they're doing this in a cowardly way, but a lot of these schools are worried about the, liability. And even the ones who are optimistic and even the ones who think increased cases without an increase in hospitalization and deaths means that we have a better chance for herd immunity, they're not going to say that out loud because they're going to be, exposing themselves to claims that they don't, care for the health and well-being of their students and or teachers. Mm-hmm. So, and then just the fact, sorry to, hog the mic here, but, just the fact that, you still are going to have a lot of schools with professors who are in that, high risk age group, and students who, maybe don't want to come back without the full options that the, colleges normally have in the past, are they going to want to come back, the students and the teachers themselves, or maybe do they want to just sit this year out until there's a vaccine or if they get all the options back to normal? So it's just so hard to have a game plan. But yeah, like I said, last few weeks really I went from I think I was sharing same mindset as you guys. It looked like, you know, yeah, we're going to have football, college football, the fall's going back, the schools are, you know, making their plans, and then as these numbers go up, like, the less confident I am that there's going to be any fall sports like what we've not what we're used to, and that if we are going to have it, at best we're going to have, you know, these conferences would just play only conference games, you know, half the season, half the games that they're used to, and you know, maybe not all the sports that they normally have. So yeah, I'm definitely not as optimistic as I was, at least about the fall sports, and we'll get to the spring sports after, you know, you guys share your thoughts, obviously.
And before Jake goes, the Patriot League, I think, had a released plan that they are going to stick amongst themselves and only, like, very local games. So, like, Colgate, for instance, they have a non-conference game against Syracuse in your FBS-FCS game. That would be okay because Colgate's only, like, about an hour from Syracuse. But otherwise, they can't travel that far for non-conference games, and I think otherwise they're going to keep it in conference, kind of like what the Ivy League's throwing around, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, well, the fall ball thing is interesting because, so, there's a lot of talk about, you know, and not to get too into, you know, epidemiology or, like, takes on what other people say on this. You know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, what the, like, how the state of the pandemic looks in the U.S. And it's, the thing is that essentially the U.S. has, like, three different epidemics because the country is so big. The Northeast looks a lot like what's happening in Europe. And as you're seeing, like, soccer leagues in Europe have all pretty much started up again. No fans, obviously. That's something that we're going to have to get used to for a long time. And, you know, it's different, but they're able to do it. Now, pro sports is a heck of a lot different than college. That's the big caveat here. While I think some of these bubbles, you know, that pro leagues are suggesting is kind of unsustainable, it's still, you know, there's a union, and there's agreements, and the players are willing to take on that liability. College athletes don't have those same protections. But the Northeast, even as numbers are going up elsewhere, like here in Maryland, it's things have really gone down. The virus isn't really spreading. Same in Virginia. Positive test rate in New York, I've seen, is down to like 1%. The best states generally with the virus at the moment is the Northeast. And, well, where is most of college across compiled? Like, where does most of the teams play in? The Northeast. We have, you know, a few southern teams, you know, Jacksonville in Florida, North Carolina, Duke, some of the ACCs, you know, they're in closer to the south, things are bad. We don't have any teams, like, where it's really bad at the moment. I mean, aside from Jacksonville, Florida, but, you know, in either Alabama or Mississippi or Texas or California. So a lot of the teams may be able to potentially, I don't know if, like, the virus would necessarily be, you know, a foremost kind of, they're more capable of doing something like a fall ball, resembling a fall ball, than, say, a lot of college football teams are, where, you know, there's, I mean, what, you got the most of the Big 12 and all of the SEC, basically, is essentially, and then some of the ACC as well, just, they can't do anything, because all their players are testing positive. Whereas opposed to, if you looked at it, the University of Maryland tested all their athletes, and no tests came back positive. Compared to, like, Clemson, where it feels like the entire football team, and LSU as well, is getting the, you know, testing positive for COVID. So, in that sense, there's, I guess, I don't want to say reason for optimism, but I think they're more capable of handling something like that. Now, the question comes up of, you know, is this going to be an individual school kind of, you know, basis? That's probably what it's going to be. Fall ball is, I doubt we'll see, like, the scrimmages you usually see in fall ball, but teams practicing, I think that's ultimately going to be down to the individual schools, and that's going to be something that the schools are just going to have to decide themselves. Are they willing to have that kind of, you know, I don't want to know if risk is the right word, but if they're willing to allow that as something that's going to take place. You know, I think the students will be on campus for most of when fall ball takes place. I know at Towson,
we are going through, kind of similar to what Notre Dame, I believe, did. We're going through Thanksgiving in person, going to class and everything on campus, and then we're switching to an online learning. But fall ball is pretty much, what, September and October? It's pretty much over by Thanksgiving. So that, you know, wouldn't be a concern there. I know that a lot of schools, Towson as well, are limiting students on campus, so like housing and things like that. It's a lot different than it is, you know, normally, where you have, you know, a lot, you know, every student, just not every student, but, you know, there's going to be less students staying on campus. But I believe athletes would probably be okay. Like, I think athletes, I assume, would still be allowed housing. Like, they would get, I don't want to say preferential treatment, but they'll be the ones who are probably won't have many issues with housing. But if, I mean, like, if there is, like, that, you know, raises some questions, as, you know, as well, like, depending on the school. If the schools can't handle, you know, a certain number of students on campus, well, then some kids may have to switch to, like, online learning, potentially. And you can't have prep. I think most of the schools that I've seen, I think there'll be, you know, students will be able to, like, the athletes will be able to stay on campus. But that's one thing that you're going to have, you know, because not a lot of the kids, most athletes don't, you know, they're not like me who live 15 minutes down the road from, you know, campus. So that's something that will have to, you know, be in place. As for, you know, football and everything, I don't know how that's all going to shake out, you know. I think that's, you know, it's just a hard, it doesn't look like there's, I don't want to make too many, because look, we're here, what, a month and a half ago, it felt like, and it said, it looks like we're going good for football, as they've said, and then all this shook out, you know. Like, the Big Ten could probably do it, and some schools in the Northeast could probably do it, but the SEC is not going to be able to do it, and the Big 12 is not going to be able to do it, and some schools in the Pac-12 aren't going to be able to do it as well. What's a season if you don't have, like, three of the conferences, major conferences, yeah? And then you look at, I saw some, you know, D2 and D3 programs have already said, you know, we're not doing it this year, we're out. I think it was Morehouse, I believe, that I saw, that said they weren't having a football season. So, you know, there may be some programs who just say, you know, no, like, we're not at the kind of lower levels. And, like, while things could maybe get, I don't see how, like, their plan was, what, you know, in a couple weeks that the kids would be, you know, they had started practices, and then, like, not, like, full pads and everything like that, but still some degree of, you know, workouts and things like that, and then just a rash of players were testing positive. Like, how are you going to get the virus under control and have kids playing football in, like, a span of 2 months, essentially? Like, we're not back on lockdown in states in the South, but there's a bunch of stuff that shut down. And so, yeah, I don't think it's feasible for there to be college football, it looks like, in the fall. Some schools could do it, but what are some schools going to do it if, you know, others can't, and teams they have, I mean, I just don't see how it gets, I don't see, like, a splinter some teams having and some teams not. That's not, you know, because then the money wouldn't be quite be the same, you know, to some degree either. But look, there's a lot of questions, I guess, as we'll transition into, you know, talking about, like, the spring. There's a lot of questions about what it could look like in the spring. How many of the players are going to play, you know? I don't know what the NFL is going to be planning on doing. I don't know if they're going to be able to do it. Maybe. But the NFL draft is normally in April. Like, are players going to want, like, when are you starting the season? February? I mean, that's pretty cold in some areas. Like, they could do it, you know? Are you going to, they started in March, and then go into June, potentially? And then what, are the players going to turn around and play again the year after, like, a couple months after that? Like, it's, I look, I mean, I guess we've mentioned so many times, the economics of college sports are that they're going to try and, like, we've seen it already, they're going to try and play college football, you know, as much, and if there is a chance, they're going to try and do it, but, and I'm not saying that playing in the spring, you know, can't happen, but, and look, by the time spring comes around, there will be lots of antibody tests and different things, you know, health measures, not on a vaccine, even though it seems like early 2021 is when that'll probably first start getting rolled out, but just other health measures, you know, I've seen that will be in place by the fall, which is good, you know, but it's, there's a lot of questions. I don't think there's an issue, and I'll get you, if you guys want to chip in, absolutely. I don't think there's much of an issue in terms of lacrosse coexisting with college football. What's the worst, you have to play on Sunday instead? You can do it. The teams who play in football stadiums, so Maryland or Syracuse or something, the football lines are painted on there anyways. It's not big deal.
That or worst case scenario, the soccer teams don't play on the football field, so you can just play on the soccer field.
Yeah, I mean, go ahead, Seth.
Yeah, no, I just love that question, Jake, because I was just thinking in my head, I was like, yeah, it's kind of like how a remora fish coexists with a shark. You know, the shark doesn't really know that it's there.
Exactly.
And the remora fish is just fine with that, too. You're absolutely right. What it would affect, obviously, is the game days just big things in my head. Big game days, if it's football or college lacrosse. I love college lacrosse. You boys know that. But there's going to be more midweek games if the football team needs the stadium on Saturday, which is cool. We've been wanting that for years. And more maybe, you know, Saturday night games if the football team is going to have a 12 o'clock kickoff, you know, maybe you have some more games at 8 o'clock or stuff like that. But yeah, no, it's yes, they can coexist, but it would be football would have the priority.
Even if it is, the athletic director will tell them, do you want to have a program next year?
Exactly. They're like, well, what do you want to do when you're not around anymore? Because that's what's going to happen if you can't
make that happen.
Yeah, because we can do that. If we can do that if you want. But I think most the coaches are realistic men, and they understand that, you know, football drives this bus for right now. And if that's what it takes to have a budget for everybody, then that's what's, you know, we'll play on Tuesday, director, no problem. I think that would be the thing. They can coexist, but it's coexisting in a way that an ant coexists with a human. Again, with all due respect to lacrosse, we love it, but that's just the facts, especially for the Big Ten and ACC. That's what point in the article. You move it to the spring, or you don't have football, and there's just this enormous hole in your budget, then yeah, you're gonna champion them moving it to the spring. Duke lacrosse wants Duke football, even though, you know, Duke football's not the biggest. Or Michigan lacrosse wants Michigan football to be playing next year because that's just the whole ecosystem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Exactly. It's like everybody's realistic at these schools. If that's what it takes to have a college lacrosse season, is that football plays in the spring, you know, they're going to be cheering for the football team on Saturdays when they normally have their games, so that they can have their games on Wednesday. That's not going to be an issue.
And hey, maybe the players will think it's cool that they, a throwback playing weekday games like they're in high school again. Might be fun.
No, I mean, the question comes down to, you know, if there can be college football, then there can be college lacrosse, and college lacrosse will do whatever they have to do. We might see a shortened season to some degree, or maybe we'll see the season push back. We can handle 1 year of college lacrosse looking weird. We've already had it this year. We can handle one more year of college lacrosse looking a little weird or different in service of college football happening.
Yeah.
That can happen. What we cannot handle is there not being college football.
Yeah.
And then having to deal with the ramifications of that. So, like, that was the main gist of the point is that, like, yeah, like, they'll be able to handle, I mean, if it's, there's less games, okay. Some people, I think, will probably be fine with that anyway. You know? If the season has to be pushed back a bit, there's a bunch of people who are in favor of that as is anyway. You know, like, whatever it may be, if the schedule, I think the schedules are going to be different. That's, like, one thing. I think the schedules are going to be different for a while. Like, any schedule agreement you have for the next couple years is probably getting ripped up and changed.
Yep.
You know, because, like, the teams that, like, Maryland and all these teams, I mean, like, they'll probably still have the money, but they're probably not going to be going out to California to play again. Yep. You know.
Pour one out for the world's greatest YouTube stream.
Yeah. You know, Duke or whatever, I mean, they already play, you know, a lot of kind of local teams anyway, but are they going to be going to, you know, Denver? Probably not. That game's probably getting replaced with, I don't know, Georgetown or something, maybe. You know, bus rides are going to be the move. There's not going to be, you know, and I don't know how that potentially would affect, you know, the NCAA tournament or something like that, but, you know, that's going to be the move from now on, is that, you know, like the Maryland schools, and I mean, a bunch of just older Maryland lacrosse fans, people in this state will just friggin' love this. Like, they're probably all going to play each other, you know, more often, as opposed to Maryland going to Notre Dame. You know, like, that's kind of going to be how it is. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. That's an aesthetic kind of deal, essentially. You know, like, the sport will be fine.
That does bring up, I guess, a kind of good point. Are we going to see, like, maybe a year or two hiatus from things like, say, a Syracuse Hopkins or a, you know, other, like, kind of inter-regional rivalries? Obviously, Notre Dame is going to have a little bit of a few holes to fill with their rivalry games. You know, things like that. Are we going to have to get used to just, like, maybe a year or two without some of our, some of these storied rivalries, you know, just for the sake of getting it all in and everything?
Now, that's a good question. I mean, I could see the Big Ten and the ACC maybe having a little bit more flexibility, like allowing one or two. But yeah, you're absolutely right. A lot of these schools are going to be like, if we can't get there by bus, we're not playing there. If we can't get there home on the same day as playing, we're not going to do that. And if you're not in our conference, we're probably not going to play you. So I could definitely see that. But I think maybe, you know, the Hopkins and Syracuse, that they'll find a way to play each other just because that game has so much importance. Obviously, Hopkins and Maryland play each other anyway in the conference, so that's not, there's no problem with that. But yeah, like Jake, as you said, like, you know, going to Cali to play North Carolina, I mean, that's, I just don't see how that's happening next year. As much as that's fun and grow the sport and all that stuff, it just ain't going to happen. I mean, just budgets are really strained right now, and they're gonna try to do you know, the conference games. I can see that that's probably going to be a priority. And if we can't play you and get there, if we can't play you and get home on the same day using a bus, it's not going to happen. I think it's probably what's going to rule the day going into the fall. Going into 2021.
Yeah, no, I think like conference schedules to some degree will, you know, change a bit. I think, you know, I mean, there's not a lot of conferences, I think, with, you know, like wide kind of imbalances in terms of, but like I could see something where Colgate, Army, BU, Bucknell, Lehigh, maybe, you know, or Colgate, like in the Patriot League, for example, Colgate, Holy Cross, Army, BU might be a division, essentially, and all play each other, because that's easier travel to handle than Loyola going to Army. And Army might play, or sorry, Loyola might play Lehigh and Lafayette and Navy. That's more manageable, you know, and for the teams, that's the only kind of conference where something like that exists. But like the, I don't know what the heck the Big East is gonna do. You know, like I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what's really gonna happen there.
And same with the SoCon, because they still got Air Force in that.
They're gonna be like, you can come to us, Denver, if you want to do that.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if like Denver Air Force and Utah just have an agreement amongst themselves for the next, you know, year or two to just make our own little conference thingy.
One thing I could also see is if schools kind of copy that Philly Four idea, like
absolutely. That's what I was mentioning with the Maryland schools. Like that's like people will love that. I mean, for sure, but that's probably gonna happen because you'll need dates. And that's the easiest way to get dates.
Yeah, have them like all one weekend, play two games that weekend, and you know. But it's we can maybe even go home that night and come back for the second game if need be. But yeah, like you could maybe see multiple game weekends with regional rivals, and that's one way of getting some non-con games in there. But yeah, no, it's good. We're going to see a lot of creativity, I think. Necessity is the mother of invention. So if you don't have enough money, you got to figure out a way to get some of these games that you want to play. You're going to see a lot of teams get creative with the schedule.
Anything else we want to address with it? Because it is a complicated situation that we obviously don't have any answers on, and it's just kind of spitballing. But obviously, this is what about 8 months out, and God knows where we're going to be with the...
A lot is going to change. A lot's going to change.
So, just spitballing of some of the few ideas that are out and about on that. We'll turn our attention. Bodie Ray wants to know, are there any news on open coaches and assistant jobs? We haven't really heard any whispers, but did anything else kind of come up as a light?
No. I mean, nothing about the Hampton job. I haven't even heard them say anything about like an assistant being bumped.
I haven't heard anything. Yeah, that's been... The trail's completely silent on that one. Hopkins obviously filled their two openings.
Quiet on the Western Front, kind of.
Really. I mean, I haven't, we haven't really heard much. I don't think IL's really reported anything. So, it all seems pretty quiet. I don't know if there's... I don't know whether it's getting coaches to, campus or things like that. I don't think that, assistants you can probably just hire over, you probably normally hire them over the phone anyway. But maybe it's, money and things like that. I know, budgets for the year, I think, come out, in a couple of days. I think it starts in, July.
Usually July 1st is your budget years.
Yeah, so maybe that's...
Because that's usually with college athletic departments when they have new apparel deals. Usually it takes into effect July 1st when you switch companies for jerseys and stuff.
I haven't really heard much.
There was a part of me that was thinking, on the fiscal year conversation, that's when we maybe will hear more about the programs and their staff. We just saw UConn about less than a week ago cut some teams because of their budget in anticipation of the end of the fiscal year they made that announcement. So that was part, I was thinking, because we were wondering, there are going to be other shoes to drop after Furman, but I think that was one thing in my mind. I was wondering, if they're waiting until the very last second when they have to announce their budgets at the end of the fiscal year, maybe that's when we'll start to hear some other stuff. But again, the cynical lawyer in me was also thinking, it makes less time for kids to make some transfer plans, if you just say it in the middle of the summer instead of doing it in May, it gives people more time to look for other options. I think we, this is the week to kind of keep your eye out there because as we always love to say, those Friday before the holiday news dumps, It is 4th of July weekend coming up this weekend, so keep your ear to the grindstone out there. So.
I know. I think the last major one that came up was OSU and Dylan Sheridan left. I haven't heard anything on plugging that opening. So.
Yeah. So the Ohio State coordinator is definitely going to be the big assistant opening at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the big assistant opening. They've had some turnover there. Over the last couple of years. It's something to keep an eye on.
Mm-hmm. And our buddy Andrew Parker, if he's still listening after us accusing Dabo of running a herd immunity camp, this is a good, interesting one. If Miles Jones played for Hobart or NJIT, do they make the tournament? What about other elite players? Which elite talent would elevate a lower program? And, of course, how does Wagner create a super weapon? Well, I guess I'll start off first. One cog helps you, but you need a little bit more pieces in the machine. We've seen that with Princeton from every year from 2011 onward.
He gave us, way different options here. It's like, so could I get... Basically, it's like, does Miles Jones make Hobart, which is a Toyota Camry, an Audi? Or does Miles Jones make your 1970 Buick into an Audi? Hobart was like, didn't Hobart make the tournament in 2015 or something like that? Or 2016, one of those years? I think Hobart was like in... Yeah, 2016 Hobart made the play-in game.
Yeah. I think it's more like...
Miles Jones would have made Hobart a quarterfinal team.
Yeah. NJIT, no, that would just, be...
No, NJIT, that's like...
You're turning a Reliant Robin with Jeremy Clarkson driving, rolling over on every turn, turn into Lewis Hamilton's Mercedes Formula One car.
Yeah. No. Miles Jones is not making NJIT a tournament team. Could Miles Jones make Hobart? I have a question. We kind of broached this with Mike a bit, Sowers. I remember our friends at Anonymous Eagle asked us, like, what would Sowers do to, like, if I had to put him in Marquette? And I was like, well, you know, he'd make them into a lot better, and I think he'd probably make them into, like, I don't know if he'd make them into a tournament team, but I think he'd make them into a contender for one. It has to be a singular talent type player. Miles Jones, Sowers, Lyle Thompson, But yeah, if you put Michael Sowers on Fairfield, who dropped 16 goals a game and was looking like maybe the best team in the CAA, yeah, they'd definitely be a tournament team. Like, they'd be in the top 11, 12 teams, if you put a Grant Ament on, comparable. I don't know, Vermont, Yeah, they definitely kind of be in the conversation, to make the NCAA tournament. But, some teams, at the absolute lower kind of, tier, Michael Sowers is not making Merrimack or LIU a tournament team. But that kind of guy would make a team... it can make them a lot better, yeah, if you got, the right, kind of guy. How does Wagner create a super weapon? How coaches sometimes fib about their resumes and, what college they went to? Wagner should start fibbing about their alumni and their school rankings, their U.S. News and World Rankings, and use it to get recruits.
The George O'Leary method.
Exactly. Wagner should go to recruits and be like, you see this here? We are actually the number 20 school in the country.
If you had TD of 2018 and 2019... plus one of those transcendent talents, you could make Wagner or an NJIT into a tournament team. Because I think if you had the face-off guy who's getting 75% to 80%, and then you had one of these, you know, true blue-chip playmakers, you know, Grant, Mike, Lyle on there, Miles on there, and who could make their offense even better, and they just had just, like, an overwhelming number of face-off wins, you could get them into tournament because, you know, they probably could, you know, win their conference in it. I don't know how far they would go into the tournament with just those two players and, like, their present roster, but yeah. But yeah, you guys are absolutely right. You put Miles or Lyle or just one of those, you know, Mike or Grant onto, you know, the Lehighs or the, you know, the mid-tier teams, and they're quarterfinal, you know, possible teams, you know, because if you already have teams with
good enough talent. Yeah, they already got good players.
Yeah, they already got guys with good players, and then you put one of these amazing, you know, all-time players on their roster. They're definitely quarterfinal, and, you know, the ball falls the right way in one of those tournament games, and, you know, maybe they make a Final Four. But, yeah, this is an interesting question. It definitely made me think a little bit.
The interesting thing is, I think, you know, I think this kind of highlights the way the game has kind of changed to some degree. And I know sometimes, like, people complain, like, with the Toronto Awards and stuff, how, like, offensive-oriented is it. But, like, if I dropped prime Brody Merrill into one of these teams, do you really think they'd be, like, do they really think it'd make that much of a difference as compared to Michael Sowers? No. And so, like, I think that just, like, I mean, it's just something, like, to think about. Like, that's maybe the best defenseman ever, and I don't think it makes, like, near the kind of difference that it would if I dropped, like, Michael Sowers or Miles Jones. I think that's just kind of how the game is, like, trending. If you need a player who's, you need, like, an offensive guy, that one of those kind of guys to change the game. Like, that's kind of how, that's just the way, like, you can look at, if you look at, you know, the teams who have won titles recently, I'm not saying they're, like, they don't have good defensive players, but look at, like, their best defensive player. Not all of them have had, like, an amazing, you know, clear, you know, top-notch, you know, defender type guy. You know, like, Virginia had some really good defenders, but I don't think they had, you know, they didn't have, you know, a first-team All-American type guy. UNC in 2016, they had Austin Papani, and Austin Papani was really good. But Denver in 2015, they had some really good D guys, but I don't know if they had, like, an All-American, but you look at pretty much every national champion going back, like, 10 years, and, pardon me, they've all got, like, a just all-world, you know, first or second team All-American attackman. Like, that's, or midfielder, I guess, in some cases. Those are the guys you need. Those are the, like, the super weapons that change teams.
All right, and one other question from Bryant LaCrosse. Straight from the source there, Bryant. How much do you want to see Bryant, Tupper, and Hartford on Memorial Day weekend? I think that's a resounding a lot, because he is one good boy.
Oh, yeah. Look at that face.
The good
look
dog.
At that face. Yeah.
He is a good dog. Why don't Bryant and Yale play each other, and they can just get, like,
yeah, the two bulldogs can hang out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We're just printing money here.
Like, I think every school that has a dog as a mascot should be required to have a dog. Like, Albany should have a Great Dane on the sideline. UMBC with golden retriever. Oh, my God. UMBC with a just lovable golden retriever.
See, we're talking, how do you create a super weapon? Like, get yourself a golden retriever mascot, UMBC.
Yes, absolutely.
Come on, who would not love a golden retriever just running around, his tongue sticking out, just wanting to be petted the entire game?
Exactly. This is the movement.
We're going to start a movement. If we can't get Saturday Night Lacrosse, which obviously we're not going to get next year anyway, get the next best thing and more dog mascots.
Or dog mascots, for sure.
Just trying to think off the top of anyone. Yeah.
This, I don't know if we exhausted the question. There was a kind of a funny thread
St. Bonaventure today or the other day. Bonnie. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, there was a kind of a funny thread. I forget the person, maybe he's one of these Barstool guys, but forgive me for not knowing. I'm just looking it up now. Jack McGuire. Soprano characters as college football teams. I didn't know if you guys wanted to do a,
that. They're all Rutgers.
Well, yeah, I was going to say that. I don't know if that was worth it, or like Sopranos or The Wire characters as college lacrosse teams, but maybe we can save that for another time. But I thought that was kind of funny.
Pardon me. Choking on water.
College lacrosse. Me and Ryan did this one time with college lacrosse coaches as like Ocean's 11 characters.
Mm. Oh my God. Who was Clooney?
Who was Clooney? God, that's a good. I'd have to go back and listen. Was it? Did we say it was Dino? I think we said it was Dino.
I don't know. I think you did all the heavy lifting on it because, as you know, if just like if you listen to Punk
yes, Soup Ryan, Ocean's 11 is a movie where George Clooney, Brad Pitt, Matt Damon, Bernie Mac, and a bunch of other stars
like
of the day.
Reese Witherspoon or whatever? I don't know.
No, Reese Witherspoon was not in Ocean's 11.
Baby Affleck? Casey?
Casey Affleck, Scott Cann, just, a bunch of just top movie stars got in a movie, and the plot is that they tried to rob a Las Vegas casino. Three Las Vegas casinos, as a matter of fact. Great film. But yeah, also just like, it's an incredibly cool film. It's like the most cool movie of all time.
It actually is. They lost some juice in the sequels, but that first one,
it's amazing.
Soderbergh really killed that one. That was really, really, really.
You just see all the people come out, and it's like, holy crap! Like they got all of these dudes in one movie.
and
Pitt is at the peak of his just Brad Pittness. Second one is more peak Brad Pitt.
Always eating. I love that.
Always eating.
Literally, every scene. He's eating
something. It's great. It was Julia Roberts, not Reese Witherspoon.
Yeah, Julia Roberts, Andy Garcia. It's a crazy ass. But yeah, like, Clooney is just Matt Damon's really young. Like, it's young Matt Damon. But, like, still really good. Bernie Mac's hilarious.
Oh, when he was like, "Do you moisturize?"
He just squeezes on the hand and he keeps going.
It just talks about lotion for like 30 seconds. It's so crazy.
I use aloe vera.
To do my best Sean McIndoe impersonation. Yeah, that's a line in a movie, all right.
No, you definitely have to watch. You definitely have to watch that. That one's...
Well, hey, I'm on summer vacation, so now I can finally binge watch things, maybe.
And the one scene where Clooney and Pitt go to find the amazing yen, and Clooney's like, "Which one's the amazing yen?" And Pitt's like, "The little Chinese guy." And Clooney just looks at him. Gives him a tremendous look. Oh, Don Cheadle has the worst English accent of all time.
Is brutal. Yeah, it is. I mean, he's trying his best. I mean, bless his heart. I love Cheadle as an actor, but yeah, it was a bad look there.
There's a scene with where Pitt teaches Topher Grace how to play poker.
Where the young Hollywood actors are like the major ones, and like Pitch is like a nobody. Yeah, that's great.
And yeah, and like it's just here's Topher Grace in here, like in the middle of that 70s show.
Topher Grace. I mean, I had all the Topher stock for a little while.
Yeah, man, that really hit the iceberg.
They really, this never really made it.
Spider-Man 3 happened, and everyone was like, you know what?
We're good, actually.
That's enough for us.
Yeah.
We are all good here.
Do you think we need another guy? All right, I'll get another guy.
I think we need another guy.
What have you been watching, Ryan?
Well, the 30 for 30s that came out. Obviously, Last Dance.
Ryan, Last Dance was like 2 months ago.
It was 2 months ago. I know, that was way back ago.
Which ones of the newest ones did you like the most? The Lance? The Summer? The Long Gone Summer?
Lance was really good. Long Gone Summer, I like the music out of it, but it was kind of jarring going back and forth between renovated Wrigley Field and the new Busch Stadium and going back and forth between 98 and then. I didn't like that direction of it, but I liked it. I like Dingers. That was good, but I think Lance was really good and kind of flew under the radar, I think, a bit.
I'll say this because this is a safe place. I will watch any Lance Armstrong documentary. He's so unself-aware and hyper-self-aware at the same time. It is like I've seen on Prime. They got 30 Lance Armstrong documentaries on Amazon Prime. Half of them are free, so you can go check them out. I saw the one where, do you remember that movie Hell or High Water, Jake, with Chris Pine? Not Chris Pine, the other dude. He played Lance in like this the actual movie that they put out. I guess like mid late 2010s or early 2010s. That was great. But yeah, I'll watch pretty much any Lance Armstrong documentary out there. Like he's just such a flawed like character, and also just so he's charismatic as well. Like
he's so compelling.
Yeah, it's almost like Jordan a little bit, and like you kind of see like that I gotta win attitude, but he's just not.
The thing with him is that like he is completely, like, unpretentiously an asshole. Like, he totally is. And then you realize that USADA basically tanked cancer research so they could hit him up for cheating at a bike race that everyone cheated in. And then you're like, man, you raised like millions and millions of dollars for a legitimately amazing cause. And now you can't because they busted you up for cheating in a bike race that everyone cheated at. But then again, man, you were like a real, real a-hole.
Yeah.
While cheating to win those bike races.
The best was like the official Tour de France documentary for the 100th anniversary that they aired on NBCSN. They're like, no doubt about it. It's like, yeah, they just openly straight up admitted, yeah, everybody's been cheating at this since it began.
He's so vain and immoral. And yet you feel sympathy for him.
Yeah.
Like, it's the most, I don't know how he pulls it off, but you look at him and you're like, God, like, you have just no, he's got, like, no, I mean, he doesn't feel any kind of, I don't want to say he feels no, to some degree he, like, feels no remorse for it. And I'm like, well, yeah, like, he cheated a bike race, like, who cares? And I'm like, man, you kind of really effed a bunch of people up through the process, though. And then I'm like,
that's it. Yeah. I want you to finish that thought, but it's the suing people.
Yeah,
if it exactly. was just denying it and just denying and denying and just leaving it at that, that would have been more kind of forgivable because you'd be like, all right, I get it. Everybody cheats on this thing, whatever. It's just a bike, as Jake O'Brien said, it's a bike race in France. But it's the turning around and suing people that really, like, and winning some of those lawsuits. Like, that was, and like, I think, yeah, when he beat some of the Fed lawsuits against him that, or the investigations against him that kind of emboldened him as well. But yeah, no. It's just, if he if he was 10% less of a jerk, he probably would have 50% more, love right now than he did.
It reminds me of that scene with McNulty and the plagiarizing reporter in season 5 of The Wire, where McNulty's like, you're just trapped in the same damn lie. And it's like, that's Lance Armstrong. He's just trapped in like the same self-perpetuating loop. Where he's like, well, I've kept an eye, I sued someone already, so I might as well just sue him again.
Gotta keep going. You can't stop.
And I'm like, on the one hand, it's like, God, that's terrible. On the other hand, I'm like, that's a really miserable way to live. I kind of feel sorry for you. I have no idea how.
But. And there was like that great line in The Office where Kelly Kapoor says something about Lance Armstrong. She's like, he really lost. He's like, I sided with Sheryl Crow in that, so I don't talk about Lance anymore.
They didn't even really they only touched upon that like briefly, that he dumped his wife for Sheryl Crow.
Then dump Crow. Yeah. Horrible.
Dude was on a heater in those days.
Yeah, he was. He was on the hot streak.
It's kind of wild, like when you realize like how big he got. It's like it was, eight years before all, like in the late 1990, like early 1999. This dude is just another writer in a pretty much obscure sport, and then 6 years later he's like best friends with the president of the United States.
He's going bike riding with Bush.
Don't even an election year. George Bush.
Don't even an election year. I was like, dude, this guy.
Every single kid in America's got a Livestrong bracelet.
Yeah, he was saying like in the documentary, like he's got Obama's cell phone number. I was like, he was riding bikes with Bush during like Bush stopped electioneering, his campaign to go ride a bike with Lance Armstrong.
I was like, he literally is riding bikes with George Bush, and then turns around the next day and is like, yeah, I really don't agree with him, his politics on anything, and he just gets away with it because he's Lance Armstrong. It's wild.
But yeah, that was a good doc.
What doc would you guys want to see? It doesn't have to be bigger than The Last Dance, but I'll throw mine out to give you guys time. I know, put you guys on the spot. I think a Bonds documentary would be kind of interesting, just because he's just such an enigmatic figure, doesn't do a lot of press, and there's still, you know, obviously a lot of people interested in the, you know, baseball steroid era. That I thought that would be interesting. Documentary. I didn't see the one on Griffey that MLB did. I'm sure that one's great. But yeah, just personally, I think something on Bonds, because he's such a controversial figure, and you know, with his history, you know, his godfather is Willie Mays, is, you know, his own father Bobby was a very good player as well, and you know, obviously Bonds is in a class of his own. But I kind of always thought a Bonds documentary would be kind of interesting, just because we don't really know that much about the guy.
Yeah, that would be an awesome multi-part one, which means ESPN's just going to give us a 10-part documentary on Jeter and the core four Yankees, and we're all going to hate everything.
the only other person who has that kind of capability is Tiger.
Yeah, Tiger would be.
Like, I would watch anything on Tiger. I think he's like the most. Like every time, like there's like a big sports figure, they're like, man, what a fascinating character. I'm like, no, he's not. Like Tom Brady, for example. There's nothing fascinating.
Yeah, it's gonna be
Brady.
10 dry, boring episodes. Though. Like, who cares? He overcame the odds. Like
there's
John
nothing
Cena.
Fascinating about Tom Brady. He's just a good athlete. Tiger Woods, like that Wright Thompson piece on Tiger Woods is like the best piece of sports writing I've ever read. I think Tiger is more fascinating. Like most people look at Tiger and it's like all the cheating and the scandal and everything, and is like, and like makes the jokes about it. And it is funny, like it's really funny. But then you read the Wright Thompson like piece about it and you realize the dude's cheating was like watching TV in a hotel room with someone just to do it. And it's like, because he just was like so out of touch with normal people interactions and emotions. Like he had been like the stuff with his dad, like I think the relationship with his dad is still so fascinating. And then even like the comeback, like the dude was like done. I mean like dunner than done. Like just so completely
washed.
Finished. Like it wasn't even like he would come like every, he would play like once a year and either pull out or look horrible, and it's like he was barely even competing, and then he comes back and wins the Masters with like two fused spines or whatever.
Yeah,
and it's like I he's like the sports stuff alone, but I think, and I mean, that's the question, is whether he'd actually like let you get into any of it. Though I guess I don't know, like how much of it did Jordan really get into himself? Like the most real guy with Jordan was like yeah, I played golf with this one dude who everyone thought was like a loan shark, and yeah, you know, it was just a hobby.
or making up that the flu game was a pizza that was tainted.
Oh god, that was hilarious. That part was great.
No, you were hungover.
I do love Jordan, just on the right side of liability, where he's just like, food poisoning. Not exactly that they did something to it. It was just food poisoning. It was just bad cheese. That's all it was.
No.
Also, Money Mayweather. Just because I was just, what could come out of that guy's mouth would also probably just be amazing.
That's another good one.
What's
yours, Rob?
Yeah, in terms of multi-part ones,
for record, not everything has to be like 10. Everyone's like 10 parts, but yeah, 10 parts is.
But
like
anything
lot.
From like 5 up, I don't know. I'm trying to think. There's, because I think as you said, Tiger's a very fascinating one. Serena could be interesting too. I think because she's been around for so long and won so many titles, that could be an interesting one too.
I got one now that I think about it. Uh-huh. Monica Seles.
Yeah, Monica Seles would be a good one too.
Oh, yeah. People don't understand. This woman was on top of the world, and then some nutcase just destroyed
it. I don't think like people like real like it's. She was literally on the greatest heater in the history of tennis,
and it's
like she was just like. I mean, it's just like she was. Beating everybody, like Steffi Graf is the best women's tennis player ever. Like I think she's even maybe better than Serena. And Monica Seles is just beating her over and over and over and over and over again, and then like loses like almost all of it, and then comes back and like wins again, like not to the same degree, which is like still like that sort of like she would have won like 30 million titles, but still comes back and continues to play. For like, and especially how young she was when like she started. I mean, like when it all happened to her, she was 20 years old.
Yeah.
Like that's the crazy thing. It's like imagine like that that happening to you, but when you're 20 years old.
If that happened today, like
sorry, not even 20. She was 19. She was 19 years old. Like
if that happened today.
Oh, go yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just trying to make a joke. Please finish your actual point. Yeah, I didn't realize she was that young. I thought she was in her early 20s. But yeah, if that happened today, like literally Twitter would implode on itself. Like it would just be a black hole on a black hole in a third black hole. Like you're just sucking all the life out of us. But yeah, it's a hard, for all you youngsters out there. Yeah, it's a, look up Monica Seles. It's absolutely tragic what happened to her.
And I mean her, so she wrote a memoir about it, where she got depression and binge eating disorder after it. Her father got diagnosed with cancer and eventually died. And then she still came back, like, basically over, like, 2 years later. And it's like, going through all of that. And like, even when she came back, she was still, like, only kind of in her early 20s. And she was never the same kind of player. Like, she won one major after that. After she had won 8 before she was 20 years old. Like, that's the, like, the women's, all of that with women's tennis, like, in terms of how young, like, they all were. And how that's changed now. Like even Serena, when she debuted, was like she wasn't even one of the younger ones. I mean, she was, I think, Serena was I believe 18 around that when she like really broke out. And even then, that was like 2 years older than some of the other ones were. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of that about that entire dynamic about how young all of them were when they started and some like the ramifications of it would be really interesting.
Another good tennis one would be the Rafa versus Roger rivalry too.
I think the whole big three, all of them. I guess Andy Murray can get grouped in there too because it just the poor guy could leave out.
And then we got Djokovic for the crazy ass quotes.
Yeah, like I don't. Yeah, Djokovic, but I don't know how Djokovic's reputation is going to handle all this.
But yeah, we could
imagine claiming that you. Probably wouldn't come back next year because you don't want to take a vaccine.
And then get somehow, the virus anyway!
And then somehow doing something worse than that. Like, imagine putting that out into the ether, and then, like, within, like, 2 months, doing something that looks worse for you than that. That's genuinely impressive.
God bless Eastern Europe. Other multi-part one, and then I'll get to my other one idea. The 80s Oilers would be interesting. The 80s Edmonton Oilers. Just because of... Like, Gretzky, you won't get anything interesting out of, but somebody's going to admit about how half that team was on cocaine, high on cocaine.
Yeah, you, you do that with, like, every NHL team. Like, they're all on
cocaine. But, the 80s Oilers apparently did it harder than anybody else.
Jordan just narking on all those Chicago Bulls dudes at the beginning of The Last Dance.
Yeah, I wasn't doing any cocaine anywhere.
I wasn't doing it.
I left the room. I was out of there.
That was amazing.
Some random 80s Bulls dude is watching that with his kids. Like, oh.
No, he's fabricating that. Yeah. And then the NASCAR fan of me, because I feel like there's been a million and one Earnhardt docs. Like, you could only do so many Earnhardt and Gordon Petty docs. I want one on the 2014 playoffs, the first elimination format playoff.
Yeah, because the light is jumping out.
Because every driver in that playoff lost their damn minds. There was, like, a fight every week in that.
That's NASCAR's best redeeming quality, is that they really market the fights. Like NASCAR is the one sport where it's like, you want to see dudes fighting? Like, yeah. Like, they'll just upload the videos on YouTube.
Yeah.
Best fights.
And they put a tweet of it, and they tag both drivers involved.
Like, they know that, like, people want to see fighting, and they're like, well, here
fighting
you go.
Fighting and crashing. That's NASCAR's, like, bread and butter.
Who did Chase Elliott get in a disagreement with this week? Well, we're going to tag both of their accounts in the same tweet to hype up the controversy.
Like, every other sport, when someone fights, is like, this is a disgusting act. And NASCAR's like, oh, damn.
Yeah, so going on? I would say 2014 Chase for the Sprint Cup would be an interesting documentary, especially with everybody wanting to kill Brad Keselowski by the end of it. Just having Keselowski's quotes.
I watched that one with Gordon when he got pissed off. It was hilarious.
That wasn't even the best one. The best one was, like, 3 weeks earlier, Kenseth jumping him in the middle of the haulers.
I love when they, like, when they punch the dudes with the helmet, when they still have their helmet on, too. It's hilarious.
Yeah, so that would be my...
That's the best part about fights, is dudes just punching each other when they have helmets on. It's like, man, you really nailed it, buddy.
By the way, Jake and I are hyped for the return of Formula One this weekend. Not because of any... I think we've said this before on the Crosscast. Definitely not because of the racing, because the racing is terrible in Formula One. You watch it for the soap opera. And the
That reminds me. I know they already did one, but Ayrton Senna would be...
Yeah, I don't know if you could top Senna, though. Senna's such a good...
Yeah, the doctor, they already did it, basically. I mean, it's already,
and Senna, like, Senna's really the good. Top five all-time documentary, sports or otherwise.
Yeah, it's so good. I don't know. I want to say Michael Schumacher, but, like, I don't... Like, what the... That's just...
Unless you let us know what the hell Zach's actual condition in
it. That's like a massive invasion of privacy. Like, to figure that out, it'd be like, you have to... Like, I don't think I want to see someone go to the risks to find out what's really going on there.
Yeah.
And of for lacrosse, I want to know the whole deal about how Rambo looked like he was kicked off the team and then came back. Like, I saw that news clip and I'm like, oh, shit. we are done here. And then it was just like, and then the first game of the year, he's back. I'm like, oh, all right.
Never to be spoken of again. That is a good one. What the cross? They already did. Where is the trophy for 1989? That was
1990. Yeah.
Sorry, 1990.
You know what would be kind of interesting?
Clearly, it's the 2020 Syracuse team.
Greatest team of all time.
I think with the 50th anniversary of the NCAA championships for men's lacrosse, you could kind of do, I think maybe we should suggest this to Chris, but I think, like, ESPN and the NCAA teaming up for, like, a little documentary about the NCAA era, how it came about, and just go through the eras and do, like, a decade, an episode would be kind of cool. Like, episode one, you go through the 70s and all that, then the 80s and 90s.
Mini doc on Bill Tierney forcing the Dive to come back after the 2017 semifinals.
Get everybody in lacrosse Twitter interviewed for it about how much they wanted it, and then what happened after, and nobody admits it except for us that it was terrible.
I mean, a whole like behind the scenes, just completely on the record, honest about like the entire transfer portal this all season. That's not like a full documentary, I don't think. But as far as like a
10-minute E60
oral history, like an oral history,
Or like an E60 like, segment would be kind of good.
Yeah, I think that'd be interesting, just how it all the pieces, you know, came together. The Virginia coaching search. That one was hilarious.
That one was good. Yes.
They're just all the twists and turns, and that one was absolutely that was fantastic. Trying to think. I guess, I mean, it's not like the most uplifting, but all the early programs that couldn't keep going. You know, like NC State.
Oh, yeah.
Ohio Wesleyan.
Yeah. Morgan State, I think, had a team, and they couldn't keep it. Yeah, just all the early teams who were in the tournament, like Washington and Lee, you know, like in the early days, who just didn't kind of have to, you know, close their programs down. I think that'd be pretty interesting.
What sports documentaries would you least want to watch? As I said, with baseball, definitely the Core Four Yankees, which you know somebody's going to make a documentary of. And it's like, nope, not wanting to hear about a above-average shortstop that somehow is unanimous.
The Patriots one is just like, I'm not going to watch a minute of that.
Didn't you already do like three documentaries on how Brady was picked so late?
Seriously, like, yeah, they already did the whole thing about, yeah, Brady not being, like, going to the sixth round. Like, they've done it already. Like,
yeah, and you've already done at least like three on Belichick. It's like, come on, I don't care.
It's like, imagine of all the options you could choose, you went straight to Tom Brady.
I think we need a hiatus on Celtics versus Laker documentaries, but we're getting one on the way.
Eventually. There's another one?
Yeah, didn't ESPN, or did they already come out with that one, the three-parter?
I've seen like three or four of these in like 10 years.
There's so many Celtics-Laker ones, like, so let's stop. There's other teams in the NBA. I don't know, would I be interested in one on the 90s Devils? Probably not, but...
Oh my god. What if I told you one person could ruin hockey for the next 25 years?
Jacques Lemaire, the trap.
There's definitely going to be people who do that. The 2011 softball game just for the grievances. Like I just want to hear all the grievances from like Desco and people on that game. Just all the Syracuse fans, just all the petty grievances about it. I want to see that one.
The history of the face-off is definitely over in that one.
So then you put the stick down like this, and you twist it like this.
Oh my god! It's just so funny with the face-off. I mean, I know that's my pet peeve, but
like if I had a car that broke continuously too.
But that's just me. No.
Actually, I wouldn't mind never seeing anything about the 94 Rangers. Actually, the 94 Rangers is kind of interesting because you have Mike Keenan about to blow a gasket on everybody and finally get the truth coming out that Messier wanted his ass gone like halfway through the playoffs or something like that.
I don't know if they've done it. All the Russian guys who came over, like some of those, like some of the stories about the dudes who defected. They really sound like
they touched the
they sound like spy movies, like the way they do it.
Yeah,
like,
they touched
they go to the mall and then they just leave.
They touched upon that on what was it? There was one. Was it of Miracles and Men? No, it might not have been.
That
one's
so good.
That one's a very good one. No, there was another one about the Russian Five. They did it. I think it was an NHL Network one or something or another. But it was, they touched upon the 1980 Olympics at first, but then it didn't center on Mogilny, but it focused on the five stars of the Russian team from the 80 Olympics, and they came back in 84 and won gold, and then most of them defected. They touched upon Mogilny a bit, but it was mainly about the core Russian five. Let me see if I had the documentary name of that. I think it is called the Russian Five. That was a really good documentary. I think it's on Netflix. Let me see. Yeah, the Russian Five. It's on Prime. But it's about the five guys who defected to the Red Wings. And it also goes off about the Konstantinov accident in 97 and everything too. But yeah, the Russian Five is a really good documentary on that. It doesn't really touch on Mogilny as much as it is the Red Wings, but it is
Mogilny. So Sportsnet did a 22-minute, like there's, it's on YouTube called Defector about Mogilny's story. But yeah, I just think it's so like Mogilny defects and literally is like essentially in Russia he's a criminal. And then he doesn't play for, like, the national team again for, like, another 7 years because, like, and it's the same thing up until recently with, like, the Cuban dudes. Like, they're literally just considered criminals. it's so fascinating.
I'm thinking of a different one, but Russian Five apparently is very good, too. Red Army is the name of it. Red Army is a 2014 documentary. That's very good, too, where again it talks about the guys defecting to the U.S. Mainly focuses on Slava Fetisov. It touches on Mogilny a bit, but the Mogilny story is absolutely incredible, which makes it even more of a crime that we're putting freaking Kevin Lowe in the Hockey Hall of Fame before Alexander Mogilny, because somebody had to be best friend because 1980s Oilers and Wayne Gretzky.
No, Ozzy Alonso, who played in MLS for a long time. Like, he was with the Cuban team when they came for the Gold Cup in the U.S. And he was literally with them at a Walmart. And then he just, like, leaves the store, sneaks out, finds a guy who speaks Spanish, and calls a dude in Miami. And, like, just never leaves the U.S. Like, he's literally with, like, it's, some of the stories are really just...
Yeah, Cuban defects in baseball would be a very interesting.
They're crazy stories. I mean, the Jose Fernandez one is obviously... Nuts.
That happens with Eritrean soccer players a lot as well, or cyclists.
Yeah, soccer players.
They'll go to some, you know, other country for a tournament and
just
go to the mall and never slip out the back.
Like they'll go like a lot of them, like, why don't they go to like department stores and they just like peel off a bit? I'm just gonna go over here and check it out.
Yeah, I just want to get some pants. I'll be right back.
Hey, where'd he go?
Where's Samuel?
And of course, I guess the 2016 Leicester City story would be kind of cool to do. Which means we're going to be stuck with all the documentaries about 2020 Liverpool. God help us. Right, Jake?
I don't really care for it. I mean, not I don't care for, but like, I don't know if we like need documentaries on like. I mean, that's like a team specifically where there's like, I don't know. The compelling thing like is, you know, like the crazy story, but I don't know like how much like I guess interesting, like the behind the scenes stuff is, because that's the cool thing about documentaries.
And at that point, I am not looking forward to Tottenham Hotspur All or Nothing on Amazon. Good God. Jake will like that, though. Because it's this year's Tottenham team. It's been an absolute train wreck.
I mean, yeah, like... I don't want a documentary, but like
Formula One, the Formula One documentary where Haas F1.
That one's great because it just shows you how much of like assholes all these dudes are.
Yeah, and how much Haas F1 is showing their asshole at everybody.
Like that one's.
And Mercedes and Ferrari only allow them to do one race a year. And then the one race Mercedes allowed them to film was the one where they didn't win, so they were all pissed off and trying to get them to erase all the footage. As we said, Formula One back this weekend. But otherwise, thanks for listening. Hope everybody's doing well. As always, you can follow us at college_cross on Twitter. And you can subscribe to College Crosscast. Fresh episodes coming whenever. You can follow me at RyanMcD29 on Twitter.
At Jake_Nazar.
And Safe is at...
Oh, am I on mute?
No, not anymore.
Oh, okay. No, yeah, I thought it... Yeah, at Erie_Barrister.
And you can follow us along on that. As usual, you can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, on Google Play. You can follow along on Spotify as well. We re-upped the Podomatic subscription, so everything's all good to go with that. And otherwise, thank you for listening. Hope you have a very happy 4th of July weekend. And as always, wash your hands, wear a mask, stay 6 feet apart. And because it is getting hot out, stay hydrated.
Becky Lynch for president.